The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you. If you can't see my outline, then you are guilty of a major crime somewhere in your life. Now, just as the lecture about the mechanics of sex is not necessarily going to be very sexy, so I stand before you about to talk about comedy, and I make no promises that I will be able to make you laugh. So it's not necessarily funny to talk about, to dissect jokes or to dissect the comic. As I said the last two times I was here, I'm working on a book about narratives, about stories. Stories are essential to our being as humans. I read a book recently it's been a bestseller, called Sapiens. Has anyone else read this book, Sapiens, by Yuval Harari? Noah Harari? Nobody. It's obviously a massive hit. In that book, he said he's an atheist, and he thinks the human advantage is our ability to tell stories. It's actually the advantage we have over the apes, over other types of human being that have existed. The human sapiens, Homo sapiens, is able to cast a vision, to dream a dream, to tell each other stories, which enables us to organize ourselves not just into tribes of 150 or so, or bands, but into cities and armies and companies to come up with visions and ideas. And I think he's right in that stories are something fundamentally human about us. There's something essential to us. The non-storytelling human society really doesn't exist. Now, so that's why I've been looking at different stories, and in particular then talking about the Christian story, the gospel story. Is it a more compelling? What has it got to say about the basic story types that we tell each other, those being epic, tragedy, and today, comedy. Now, what about comedy? A comedy is, surprisingly, not just about making us laugh, it's also extremely moral. So what I want to say today is that comedy is the most moral of story types. It's about judgment. And that may surprise us because comics and comedians place themselves on the progressive left of politics, where they seem to be in a kind of radical, cool, hip space. And yet, I wrote an article actually for The Drum a couple of years ago about the sanctimonious nature of contemporary comedians, because when you have eyes to see, comedians are extremely moral. They are as pompous as any preacher. They are as prescriptive as anyone who thunders from a pulpit, because comedy itself, by its very nature, it holds things up to ridicule. It says, here is order, here is chaos, and humour is its instrument to restore, to point to an order. So the human being in comedy is a human being who will be judged. Laughter exposes and corrects. Now, I got this from reading not just Freud, who talked about jokes in our subconscious, but also two theorists of the comic, Henri Bergson and George Meredith. And you can read their very interesting essays on comedy. They're freely available. You can get them for very, very little money on Kindle. In summary of their kind of thoughts, I have five points which kind of describe what they say about comedy, this most moral of story forms. First of all, they say comedy is ahistorical. That's important for us because epic is highly historical. Epic says that we move from this point in history to this point in history, and now because of the epic, things have changed. That's how we got here. Les Murray's epic of Anzac, for instance. We have an identity as Australians now because of the Anzac moment. But comedy's not like that. If you think of The Simpsons, for instance, has Bart Simpson ever graduated from primary school in the last, how many years now is it? 25 years, 25 seasons of The Simpsons. Bart Simpson has remained at about 9 years old in that entire time. The whole method of the comedy of The Simpsons is that we see a half-hour episode, chaos becomes order, and so we can start again. Nothing moves, and occasionally, occasionally contemporary figures come in, but nothing in the Simpsons' life moves. It's not about moving events from one to the other. It's more universal than that. Although jokes don't translate across cultures necessarily, it is certainly the case that the comedy is not particular to times and places like that. The comic story shape is ahistorical. The second thing to say about comedy is that comedy takes place in a fallen world. It's a world in which there already is chaos, and that's why comedy exists at one level, to remedy or to soothe the chaos that exists among us now, or to lighten it even. And so it names the fact that there is disorder and chaos and draws the comic vision out of that. Often, the reason that there is chaos in the world is because of an excess or misdirected desire in human beings. We love too much, or we are too interested in money, or whatever vice it might be. This excess of desire upsets the delicate balance of human life and human society, and then creates the tension, which is then resolved by the comedy, by the plot. And so that's the third thing to say about comedy, is that in comedy a surprising order emerges from chaos. A surprising order. That's, at the very level of a joke, right? A joke, a pun, is where you take two things and you yoke them together, and you haven't seen that those two things actually are connected, and all of a sudden an order is produced from something that you hadn't seen before, even as we play with words. A great comic plot does the same in the Seinfeld episode, which is my favourite episode of all, which is the one where George Costanza discovers, pretends to be a marine biologist, and he's walking on, you know this episode, he's walking on the beach, and there's an ailing, with a girl he's trying to impress, there's an ailing whale in the surf, and he goes into the surf, and he reaches, because the girl has said, "You're a marine biologist, you'll know how to help," and he reaches into the blowhole of the whale and discovers a golf ball that Kramer had earlier in the episode, he'd said, "I'm going down to the beach to hit some golf balls from the sand into the sea." You couldn't have predicted that. And even though I know the ending, in fact, watching it again and again, I kind of allow myself to be surprised. And this surprising coming together of order out of chaos is what comedy does. It resolves things in a surprising way that we haven't. Delights us and makes us laugh. It might be a gentle laugh. It mightn't be hilarious. It might be, as in many of the comedies of Shakespeare, that somehow the couple that we thought should be married, but we can't see how, given their differences, how that's going to happen. The obstacles are, in a surprising way, taken away, and we then get the two come together and get married at the end. Frequent end of many comedies. You see that in Pride and Prejudice, for instance, which is not laugh out loud comedy, although Dr. Tim Wright, who's now the headmaster of Shaw, once said to me when he was teaching science at Trinity Grammar when I was a student, he said he used to read Jane Austen on the train, and he'd be sitting there chuckling away, because she actually is rather uproarious in the way she writes, and people were looking at him rather strangely while he was laughing at Jane Austen on the train. So surprising order emerges from chaos, and as I said before, number four, a moral vision is cast in comedy. There are particular virtues that are praised. There are particular vices that are exposed as ridiculous. And the judge in the moral vision of comedy is the plot. The way a good comic author does it is he just says, the universe, in a way, the order of events bring about this judgment. I don't have to say that there's some god or whatever it might be. It's just that the way things happen bring folly to light. They expose folly for what they are. In satire, of course, it can be quite brutal, the way this happens. It can be quite sort of there can be real passion and heat in satire. But even in gentle comedy, we expose vices, and the way that happens is just through the sequence of events. Lastly, the comic vision identifies a community, not with a shared history, but with a shared moral vision. So just as in epic, who's an epic written for? It's written for the people who are identifying with this epic. I mean, we read Homer and we read Virgil as overheroes, if you like. We're not Romans and we're not Greeks. They're not our epics. We read them with a different purpose. We're not an intended audience. But as in comedy, we are sort of brought into the sort of intended community with the author and the players on the stage. Then we're all agreeing. That's what comedy does. When we laugh, we show common. We share something. The power of laughter, in fact, is that when we laugh together, we agree. And you know, if you've ever done any public speaking, if people are laughing with you, not at you, you know you've got them, because you're sharing something. And that's the power of laughter for a common vision. Just to kind of run this series of points through Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. You've read Charlie and Chocolate Factory? Everyone knows that. That story, it is a typical medieval morality play which uses comedy to expose vice. You can see that it's ahistorical, it takes place who knows where, who knows when. It doesn't really matter when it takes place. You could tell the story with slightly different twist and it would still be the same story, a different context and it would be the same story. It doesn't move things, it doesn't change the history of the world, it doesn't describe how we got here. It takes place in a fallen world, a world in which although a man, Willy Wonka, wants to do enormous good, he cannot do. He has closed his factory for many years. It's a world in which there is greed and in which people are nasty and vindictive. It's a world in which there is great poverty. And Charlie Bucket and his family, of course, remember, his grandparents all sitting in the same bed. They live on very, very little money, but yet they have virtues. They are generous and kind and loving. A surprising order will emerge from the chaos of the great competition for the golden ticket. We find that Charlie, of all people, gets one of those tickets. It's by what power does he get this ticket? It's the power of the plot, the magic power of the plot that gives this boy a chance. And we see as he goes to the factory and you see the other children there, you see virtues and vices, and you see these vices become punished. So of course you get, do you remember Augustus Gloop, the great big greedy nincompoop? I really love Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, right? With the Oompa Loompas singing the song. What happens to him? He goes up he goes down to the Chocolate River and he goes up the pipe, and then, didn't you read this to your kids? And then there's Violet Beauregard, and she's the one who chews gum incessantly, and she turns into a purple berry. And then there is Veruca Salt, that's the best name of all, Veruca Salt. Can't remember what happens to her. And then Mike TV, of course, wants to be on TV, and he gets kind of reduced into a tiny, tiny figure like this. So their greedy vices get punished. The only one who is rewarded throughout the story is Charlie, whose humility and kindness and patience is rewarded by being given as much chocolate as he can eat, which is really a case of diabetes, is no prize at all. So there we agree, don't we? We see those figures, we see Augustus Gloop, and we think, yes, fat people deserve to be sucked up pipes because they're bad, inherently bad, and we don't like annoying children, and they're punished, and that's the delight of it. We love seeing them punished, and it's wonderful to rejoice in the pain of others who we think deserve it. That's how a comedy works, the comic world. So I want to then turn a little bit over to what Christians have said about comedy, because Christians have had a rather difficult relationship with comedy over history. In fact, there was a strong anti-comic movement in the Christian tradition. They asked whether God was laughing, and they came up with the answer, well, no, God doesn't laugh, and actually human beings shouldn't laugh either. So that Augustine once said, men weep and they laugh, and it is a matter of weeping that they laugh. John Chrysostom, the great preacher of the 4th century, he said that the image of God is distorted when we laugh. The face of man is distorted when we laugh, and we should not, so therefore we should not laugh. The rule of Benedict, which is the earliest monastic rule, condemned laughter amongst monks. They should not laugh. You may have watched The Name of the Rose, the great movie which was made of Umberto Eco's book, terrific book, about medieval Europe. It's a medieval murder mystery. And in that book, there is a monk who murders others in order to stop a copy of Aristotle's work on comedy being distributed or being copied and studied. And in fact, he then destroys this book, this mythical book, Aristotle's comic work, because he says God doesn't laugh and it's bad that we laugh and we must not have laughter. And so the church is seen as standing against the comic. And there's definitely this strain of opposition to comedy. And there is something, we must say, that's right about this, because there are some things that are too serious to laugh about. We cannot, at one level, human beings laugh in the face of things that are more serious, when we should weep. Recently, there was very negative reaction to jokes being made about the Harvey Weinstein incident by James Corden. You might remember this just recently. And at one level, the response was right. This is no laughing matter. And although his laughter, I think, did expose a vice, it also, at the same time, minimised it. And people were saying, hang on a minute, there's something serious here. We cannot just laugh all the time. That lightness of touch, though it may have a serious purpose, is not sufficient for the reality of the world. The comic does not suffice for everything. And we should have tears on our faces as well. It shows us when we are able to weep with those who weep too, that we understand what life is like for the rest of the world. And so there's something I think we shouldn't just condemn the Christian tradition in this opposition to laughter. However, particularly in the 20th century, there's been a response from a number of different thinkers, particularly C.S. Lewis, which has been very much in favour of Christians of a Christian view of the comic. And so C.S. Lewis particularly pulled this out in the Screwtape Letters, which is amusing in its own way, but he said one of the great tricks of the devil is in fact to either produce a trivializing of everything, but also to make man humorless is also a kind of demonic trick, according to C.S. Lewis. And he described four jokes. He talked about joy and fun, and he said they're very closely related, joy and fun. Fun is just playfulness. Joy is a deeper sense of pleasure, but pleasure with expectation involved, happiness with expectation and hope. And he talked about flippancy. He was against flippancy. I think he thought flippancy is where the limits, the boundary of comedy should be. Flippancy trivialises that which shouldn't be trivialised. But then he talked about the joke proper, what he called the joke proper. And he said in the joke proper, we see, as I've talked about comedy already, order produced, surprising order produced from chaos. We see the possibility of reconciliation where there has not been any before. He says, laughter in this sense is a peculiar coming together that is given to us, which is a precursor or a mirror, an intimation of what the gospel itself does, of what God does, in particular in the work of the cross. He gives us an example of this in The Magician's Nephew, where there is the jackdaw. Becomes the first joke, and all the animals laugh, the animals that can talk, they laugh and laugh and laugh, and Aslan, the jackdaw, says, have I just told the first joke? And Aslan says to him, no, you have become the first joke, you are the first joke. But it's a very pleasant laughter. It's not in any way nasty or flippant. It is this kind of bringing together of the animals in a moment of joy, a proper joke. Richard Niebuhr, great American theologian, once wrote that humour is in fact a prelude to faith, very much along the lines of Lewis here. Humour and faith have a similarity. When we see something unforeseen, We see something we couldn't have seen before, an order that's produced from chaos. We understand something of what faith it is, or what faith is. Laughter, he says, it soothes, but it does not solve things. Only the cross, though, does that. But laughter, humor, comedy actually shows us, points towards what the gospel does. The gospel is, as Dante called it, a divine comedy. In that we see a resolution produced from chaos, but it is a deeper resolution than comedy, not just a soothing one, but a solving one, as God reconciles the world to himself. So I've got then, as I come to a speedy finish, five things to say as a Christian response to comedy. The first is this: that human beings are finite and bodily, and yet are made to reflect the glory of God. And so, in that, we kind of have an incongruity, but it's a natural incongruity. It's a kind of it is in one sense ridiculous that a creature with bowels can convey the image of God. And there's a kind of joy in that. There's a kind of delight in that, that idea of God, that a creature that burps and farts could represent the holy bodiless God who lives in unapproachable light. People like us with foot odour and toenails, you know, whose hairs clog, I won't go on, clog the drains of our showers. We are both ridiculous and tiny, and yet we reflect the image of God. And in fact, he became one of us in our finitude and bodiliness and shared all those ridiculous parts of our anatomy, and yet was divine. So that's kind of, there's something funny, comic about that. Secondly, Christianity, though, is deeply historical, and so that's where we would take issue with the ahistoricality of comedy. The moral vision of comedy just says, here are a bunch of rights and wrongs, and we right them by exposing them. Whereas Christianity says, no, there are a series of historical events, things that happened, that are definite points in history. History is being changed. So we cannot be satisfied with that ahistoricality, ultimately, as Christians. But thirdly, the invisible and unforeseen order of creation is revealed in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The resurrection of Jesus Christ, you might say, is the extraordinary unforeseen moment, punchline of the Christian gospel, which reveals that the creation itself, though it's broken and fallen and we can't see, we can kind of guess at its order, we can guess that there must be order there, but then it's when we guess that is often taken away from us. We see in the resurrection of Jesus Christ the future consummation and resolution of all that disorder, and so we see that that order that we cannot see as we look around, we can only kind of guess at, we see that in the resurrection. Again, something comic about that. The atonement itself. The atonement is an extraordinary punchline in that we have two seemingly irreconcilable opposites yoked together in an extraordinary way which can only bring a smile to our faces. That is, justice and mercy are reconciled. They meet. It's not then just a matter of moral judgment. What we get in the gospel is superior to moral judgment because it's both moral judgment. It exposes injustice and vice in human beings, and declares it to be wrong. But it also finds a way through human. It doesn't just simply condemn. I mean, at its cruelest, of course, comedy just writes off other human beings. That's not what happens in the atonement. And yet, there's this remarkable yoking together of opposites, bringing together that mystery of God's justice and God's mercy. Those two seemingly paradoxical qualities that he has in the cross of Jesus Christ. And lastly, the Christian hope makes much space for joy. We could have a whole session on what joy is, of course. I think it's a unique quality, a unique thing that Christians possess. James talks about having joy even in the midst of trials. Joy as a quality does not deny tears. Joy looks beyond tears. Joy is bigger than simple happiness. Happiness is forgetful of the world. Happiness is a moment. You can kind of be happy so long as you don't think too much about other people your suffering, or about the fact that the world is sliding into chaos and that we all end in the grave. You can kind of be happy as you forget, but joy does not forget. Joy hopes, and so hope transforms happiness, moments of happiness and even moments of tragedy, into joy, which is this deeper quality, this deeper comedy that we are offered in the Christian gospel. I look forward to your questions. I wrote an article on dad jokes once as well, and I think if you are a dad or a mum, I think the business of telling dad jokes is this is entirely secular comment. It's really important. They're very much derided, but it's very important way of teaching, especially serious teenagers, about the light, the joy of life, the playfulness of life, and it's extremely important for them as they learn how language works. And so I think tell those bad jokes and make your children groan as much as possible. So when my daughter says, "Can I leave the table?" I always say, "Where are you going to leave it?" And that's some of my best material. Don't you? And she does that teenage eye roll, but she'll love me for it one day. An early psalm, Psalm 19, has God laughing at the plans of men. I think it's Psalm 2. God enthroned in heaven laughs. Is this like the same as human laughter? Well, it's interesting. God doesn't laugh too often. We don't hear him laughing too often in the scriptures, but he laughs especially at human pretensions. There's a sort of it's a dark moment. He scoffs at human arrogance, and so it exposes human pride, because compared to our pride, it's a sort of Tower of Babel moment. I think the Tower of Babel is a kind of a satire, in the sense that there's a human arrogance is just nothing. It's this immense tower. It's a pimple on the earth. God has to come down from heaven to see it. He can't even see it from heaven. It's so small and insignificant. And I think that's so. It serves that same function. It has a kind of judgment in it. That laughter in Psalm 2. There's another couple of places for laughter. Interestingly, Isaac, the second in the series of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, the great patriarch, his name means he laughs. Now, when Sarah heard that she was going to get pregnant over 90, she laughed. She laughed at the promise of God, because it was ridiculous. And then when he was born, of course, that laughter was turned to a deeper joy. And so Israel is the family of the children of the living and the laughing, and then of course Jacob is the grasping, but that's another story. Why is there no one funny on the right side of politics? I think we've become, I don't think that's necessarily true. Americans do it better than we do. There's a couple of characters I'm not terrific fans of, like Milo Yiannopoulos, etc. He's quite amusing. Also O'Rourke in America, they do kind of right conservative satire. You'd say Swift was quite conservative as well. We've just become used to comedy as a sort of more progressive movement, and we've become used to that sort of pose. I would say though, what we call sort of left-leaning satire or left-leaning humour is not progressive or transgressive whatsoever. It's extremely conservative, in that what we get from our television screens, it very much norms the liberal view. It norms it. It kind of, in this patronising way, says, yeah, those conservatives, you know, they obviously they can't, you know, they drool, and they it heaps ridicule and sort of norms this sort of centre in terms of a left. It's not actually transgressive. So I wrote that in my article about the sanctimoniousness of TV comedians, and I went down. I was invited to go on the Charlie Booker's show, which is on the ABC, which is called You Never Watch It Either. He used to be on The Project, and he's one of the most sanctimonious of all. and are very preachy. And I said, you're a preacher. And I'm a preacher, and I find you preachy. And so I was invited to go on it, and eventually the interview was not shown. But I tried to start off by saying to him, I said, my problem is you're not radical enough. You're actually just, you know, you're very predictable and safe. You're playing to a safe crowd. You don't actually challenge your audience because your audience will agree with you. So this, even though we might say right and left, I think there's a deep conservatism to the kind of humour we get on our television. So we know as it's a safe left, not a challenging left. People love to say that God has a sense of humour. Is there any evidence for this in the Bible? Yeah, he mocks human pretensions to scorn. So if you do say God has a sense of humour, it's that it's there, which is not a very nice moment of sense of humour. I think what we tend to say is that in God's providence, he brings together unforeseen things and does his work in ways that we don't predict. And so he gets he and she together, and we never would have thought that, or you know, whatever it is, or I've ended up doing this and I never would have thought I did that. And so I think there is a sense in which the way God works in providence, where Joseph says, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. There is something which that comment truly describes in the way God works. And I think that's true in the cross and in the resurrection of Jesus. The way in which God brings order from chaos is an extraordinary work. Is it humorous? It's delightful. It's delightful beyond delight. Is it appropriate to use comedy in sermons? Well, John Chrysostom said no, definitely not. I think it is appropriate to use comedy in sermons for the reasons that Niebuhr and Lewis said, that comedy itself is a kind of intimation of the way in which God works. And I think it's important, but I think it's important to use comedy not in that satirical exclusionary way. I think it also has an enormous power to expose human folly, and that we should be in the business of exposing human folly. So I think it does have a role. My ability to tell jokes in public was killed off by being a school chaplain. So when you go to St Andrew's Cathedral School and you try to tell jokes to teenagers, it just falls flat every time, every single time. So I gave up. Was Jesus turning water into wine at the wedding a totally serious event? No, I don't think so. I think, again, there's a sort of delight in it. There are many comic moments like that. I think Jonah is full of comedy, for instance, the book of Jonah, mostly against the prophet, which is interesting, kind of a ridicule of him or exposing of his folly. Jesus' parables, there's a kind of tone of humour in his voice. G.K. Chesterton, the great apologist, in his fantastic book called Orthodoxy, at the end he says, you know, we see Jesus weep, we see him grieve, we see him full of compassion, but we don't see him laugh. And he says, I wonder, did he conceal his mirth? That's the last line of his he concealed something from us, and I wonder if that was his mirth. That's the last line of his book. But I think there is a tone of wry humour in much of what Jesus does, and I think again a sort of delightful playfulness about this water into wine. There's an excess of it, and a surprise in it, a sense that here the best has been left till now, and we never would have guessed it. How should Christians respond to secular comedy that is disrespectful of God? Jokes about God, Jesus, things that slander Christian morals or worldview. The example I would want to use is the Mormons. The Book of Mormon, the musical, is one of the funniest and most savage and best regarded musical comedies of the last generation. It's coming to town soon. When it went on stage in Broadway and then in LA, what did the Mormons do? Did they go to the Anti-Discrimination Tribunal and say, because it's extremely rude to the Mormons, I've got to say, did they picket? You know what they did? They took out a huge ad in the program and they said, you've seen the musical, now read the book. And they put on evangelistic programs, and one high profile ex mayor of a small politician in LA became a Mormon through their program that they did through seeing the musical, reading the ad. He then went and became a Mormon. So I think that playfulness, if you believe in a sovereign God, then a bit of satire. I mean, God doesn't need our protection. You know, he's not threatened by disrespect. It's just sad. And so I think we can meet it not by legislative, not with legislation, but in particular by trying to throw people a little bit off beam by saying, by an invitation and an expectation of hospitality. That's what the brilliance of the Book of Mormon thing is, that they've thrown their would-be opponents off beam, and they've made, you know, they've been given a lemon and they've made lemonade out of it. And I think that's an opportunity here. We don't need to be afraid. We can correct the record, I think. I mean, there's many instances where you could argue the toss and etc., but I think that's certainly the case. If comedy takes place in a fallen world, does that mean that there won't be laughter or joking in heaven, or will there be fun and joy but not flippancy? And you've answered the question, I think, exactly. It will be fun. There'll be the laughter of delight and playfulness and joy, but there won't be that need to bring order from chaos, because there is the divine order. Having said that, there might be the business of bringing the new heavens and the new earth. There might be work there where we do productive and interesting and delightful things. We compose music, for instance. There's a bringing of order from chaos from that. But I'm speculating at that point. Whatever the disorder will be, it won't be a disorder that threatens order, but a disorder that prompts us to make order. So, not that kind of flippancy. A Christian, a Jew, and a Muslim walk into a bar, and the barman says, "Is this some kind of joke? Thank you." Debt cancels all engagements. Thank you also. There's some more. That was from Max Beerbohm in 1911. Outside a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside a dog, it's too dark to read. Groucho Marx. Yes. Why do Australian comedians depend on foul language to be funny? It's very interesting, the scatological humour. I mean, scatological humour, it is that sort of recognition that we, as the image of, we're the image of God, we are paradoxical creatures. We are the glory of the universe and the garbage as well. We are sort of, and that's what scatological humour does. It reminds us of our bodiliness. I think the power of the taboo word is shock. And that's where the surprise element is what it does. That's why it is a kind of cheap laugh, because by saying something that we could not say, it certainly kind of produces that surprise in us. And I think that's why foul language is so common. I think it is cheap. You should listen to Milton Jones, who's a British comedian, who's a Christian, who tells lots of puns, and he never swears. And Tim Vine, who is the same, who likewise. I've got three or four questions which I'll answer really rapidly. Are not comic writings and actors often using comedy as a form of escapism, like Tony Hancock? Well, quite possibly, but Tony Hancock never escaped, you have to say. There's an exposing of folly in Tony Hancock's humour. He died in 1964, I think, is that right? By committing suicide. It's interesting how often comedians turn out to be depressive characters, by the way. So there is an attempt to use that comedy to soothe rather than to save, but we can see how ineffective it is, really. Should Christians be involved in satire of society or of other Christians? I think so. I love the Babylon Bee, a website which satires other Christians. Or satires itself, and I think exposing folly and reforming is a good thing to do. So, and I think also, I think exposing pomposity is good, but it's got to be constructive for Christians. I think it can't be that sort of condemnatory judgment. There are different kinds of judgment, aren't there? You can judge to connect, and you can judge to condemn. There are different kinds. Why do you think that most Australian comedians swear? We've talked about that. What of Elijah's mocking humour about Baal in 1 Kings 18, that his worshippers may need to shout? Yes, idolatry is exactly one of the things that the Bible laughs at the most. It is stupid, and the Bible is not kind of backward in saying so. That basically, if you have to cut yourself to make a god, to make your God hear you, then perhaps he's gone to the toilet, or perhaps he's having a nap, you know. Perhaps your gods are really not very godlike. You know, if you actually make a fire out of a piece of wood, and out of the other half of the piece of wood you build an idol and you worship it, can't you see what's going on there? Isn't that as silly as it... I mean, that really is silly. I don't think there's a problem with... I mean, that's pretty strong humour, but it tells an important truth, a theological truth indeed. Thank you, Peter.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.